Hello there, I'm Tim and he's John, and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Hello everybody.
Watcher.
More games.
It's what we're playing.
Yeah. No things, just games.
Just games, okay. Yeah, let's get back to basics. I'm going to talk, well, what do you want to hear about first? Do you want to hear about Kerbal Space Program or Guild Wars 2 first?
Kerbal,
okay. I finally got Kerbal and I'm playing it. Yes, hooray.
Welcome to 5 years ago.
Yeah. I mixed impressions, to be honest. So I fired it all up and to be honest, it's absolutely terrifying. And
it is terrifying.
Complicated and very difficult as well, I'm finding, which I'm not used to, frankly, in my gaming. I don't play games to be challenged intellectually or dexterously.
We use that as a
whatever word. I don't know. So everyone knows what Kerbal is, I suppose. But yes, I'm come new to it, and I'm just starting. I've worked through most of the tutorial stuff to begin with. So you're basically in charge of designing and launching rockets for the Kerbal space program. And the Kerbals are little people, green people with huge grins, big boggly eyes, and they like to go on space rockets, whether they want to or not.
They like the terror.
They do like the terror. And you put them in, you build a space rocket out of various different components and launch it, and try and steer it sometimes, and that rarely goes well. And then you can put them in orbits and things, and visit other planets and other moons, and do landers and stuff. And it is a very realistic, I suppose, space simulation. It's so far
simplified
removed,
but accurate.
Yes. It's all about orbits and delta V and rocket separation and trying to calculate paths around various orbital bodies and so on, so that you can do transfer orbits and maneuvers and so on. Absolutely, totally unlike almost every other space game I've played or play or enjoy. And it's a lot of hard work, I'm finding.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like it or not. That's the thing. So I worked my way through the tutorial things because I thought, there's no way I'm just going to fire straight off into medium difficulty career mode straight off the bat here. I have no idea what I'm doing in any sense or shape or how to do any of this stuff. And that was just as well. I mean, it does give you some decent tutorial stuff. I really would recommend playing them rather than skipping them. So you start off with, on the launch pad, launching your first rocket and then building rockets out of components, then various sort of low orbit manoeuvres, getting into a stable orbit around the planet. Kermin?
Yeah.
Kermit? I don't know, whichever. The place that Kerb... Oh, it's Kerbal, isn't it? Are they Kerbals or is it Kerbin? Kerbin's the planet, yes.
Yeah.
Right, fair enough. So you end up in all about getting crafted into orbit through multiple booster stages and so on. Then circularizing orbits. Then there's a set of chained tutorial missions where you go to Moon, which is the Kerbal's moon. That involves transfer burns to get into slingshot orbits around other bodies, and then once you get there, slowing down in such a way that you end up in a circular orbit and don't fly off into space. Then landing on a planet with no oxygen, landing on a planet with oxygen, you have to do the... you have to land on Kerbin as well in one of the earlier missions. Then taking off from the moon and coming back and somehow managed to successfully land on Kerbin again, and it's about as far as I got. There were some other sort of tutorial missions. One where you have to rescue some Kerbals who are stuck in a orbiting spacecraft, so you have to try and get your spacecraft to try and dock with it, and I tried that one again and again, and I couldn't do it, so I gave up. So I couldn't even make it through the tutorials, to be honest. There were some more tutorial missions there about intercepting asteroids. I'm not quite sure what you're meant to do when you get there. I'm not sure if the idea is to be steering them away from or into Kerbin. Yeah, comets and so on, I guess. But I got sort of stuck on the docking with another thing mission. There's a lot of weird HUD symbols and directions and boostings and stuff, and I'm just not very good at it all. I mean, I can see... So a lot of the missions, you have a thing where you set up manoeuvres in your orbital view, and then once you've set the manoeuvre up, you're given HUD symbols to tell you which way to point the rocket and a little bar saying how long to burn for and stuff. And I like the automatically point at the thing I want it to point at button. I like that a lot. You don't get that in the campaign mode, which is quite irritating. I'm really, really bad at steering the rocket because you get this sort of nav ball thing in the middle of the screen, which is like an artificial horizon, I guess, based on being inside the rocket. But you're not really inside the rocket a lot, so you've got this external camera view, which means makes no difference to what you're actually looking at. It's very difficult to work out what way the rocket is pointing in relation to the nav ball thing, so I have trouble with that a fair bit. And then, so yeah, I mean, pretty much you've got three ways to interact with the rocket. You can point the rocket, maybe, if you've built the right parts. I have a lot of trouble pointing the rocket when it's taking off. I guess most people don't try and point the rocket when it takes off because it's going too fast to steer.
You take off for a while and then you rotate. You do what NASA do.
Yeah, yeah. It does walk you through all this in the tutorials, but I was having such a hell of a time of it. Then you have the... So you point the rocket. You can burn the motor or not burn the motor. And some of the more advanced motors have a speed gauge, a velocity throttle, as it were.
You mean the liquid ones?
The ones with, like, oxidizers and fuel. Yeah. So some of them you can do that. Some of them are solid fuel boosters where you just turn them on and they go and you've got no control over them whatsoever, and they burn out when they run out of fuel. And that's quite terrifying and quite counterintuitive as well. So I'm not really good at burning the rocket either. You got this bar which tells you, it counts down to when your maneuvers need you to burn the rocket, and then the bar runs down. You know, you basically burn for as long as the bar, until the bar runs out, and then you stop burning, and I always miss the stop point as well, so that's quite bad. So I end up with the different orbits than the one I have programmed in usually, so then I have to do corrective burns and then I run out of fuel. Then you can also detach bits of the rocket. So it's your staging options. You build your rocket in... very early on, you unlock a thing which lets you eject bits of the spent fuel rocket and so on. And you stack those up in an order. Basically, every time you press space, it does the next thing in the sequence.
Yeah.
Which can be eject spent boosters or ignite a new engine or deploy the parachute or whatever. And I'm relatively good at pushing space when it tells me to, apart from the times when I keep frying my parachutes. So I'm not really a very good rocket scientist at all. It turns out rocket science is really difficult. So there we go. I mean, I managed to sort of muddle my way through most of the tutorials, but I gave up sort of towards the end of the tutorials because they were too difficult. So I thought, oh, let's just get on with the campaign mode, then maybe I can practice some of the really early stuff again. And I managed to take off and do some science with some mystery goo things and have the crew tell me what they saw out the window. So the campaign mode, it starts you off as, you know, you're in charge of the space program, and it gives you a series of contracts, which I suppose are your missions, are your objectives. You sort of work through trying to do these various things, and they come in various shapes and forms. One of them was just take off with a rocket. I managed that one. Hooray! Then it sort of gives you, I think some of the earlier missions are things like... test this particular component. So you need to unlock the component by spending your science points, which you're earning by taking observations in various parts of your flights, and also by completing some of these contracts. So you need to build a rocket with that component on and fly it. And the trouble is, the contracts often say things like you must be doing speed between speed X and Y and at altitude A and B.
Yeah.
So you've got to be going at a certain speed through a certain altitude band as well to make that thing tick off. And I had so much trouble trying to design rockets that would be going at the right speed at the right height for these things. So a lot of trial and error there. You're in this massive sort of vehicle assembly building trying to put different bits of booster together, and you have to pay for it all with data points or some sort of Kerbal money that you earn by doing various missions and so on. I haven't seen, because you can always keep pushing revert if it goes wrong and it'll take you back to the assembly building. You can try building a different rocket, so I don't think you're going to run out of money anytime soon, although there are options you can try, and you can have a massive bailout grant at the cost of reputation. I'm not quite sure how reputation features into it all. Maybe certain missions are only available once you've proven you're basically competent or not. It's an odd old thing. So then I had a series of missions where you have to conduct an observation of certain parts on Kerbin's surface.
Yep.
Below a certain altitude, and I got really stuck on those. That was such an exercise in frustration. I think it took me 8 or 9 goes to get the first one of those right. I just kept sailing way over or steering the wrong way.
Those are a lot easier if you make a plane.
But making a plane needs you to have a whole load of career science unlocks further down. So I don't know. Obviously, a helicopter, just fly over there, you know, or get the bus, get a train. That's easy. But no, so I thought, bugger, I'm going to do this. And so I ended up spending about 8 or 9 goes trying to do dumbfire ballistic trajectories that sort of intersected the target area. And it did work in the end. And I was so relieved and pleased that I immediately saved, shut the game down and went off to play something fun for a bit. And I think I've been back once or twice since, but I've had to really psych myself up to it. It's one of those really weird games. The Anno 2070 is one of these for me. My Anno 2070 save game is such an elaborately tottering, out of control thing that if I run it at all from this point on, it's going to crash catastrophically. So I'm never playing Anno 2070 ever again.
Anno 2070 again because I forgot it had existed.
Well, there's that too. Yeah, but I mean, it's a different thing, city builder, sort of, you know, that kind of game. But this is really shaping up to be that for me. I'm getting to the point where I'm just so pleased I managed to do mission 3 that I'm terrified of trying any more in case it ruins it all, you know. I mean, it's not one of those campaign type, homeworld type experiences where, you know, you must get it right all the way along and it just gets higher and higher stakes as you go, but it's just, I don't know, hard work, you know. That's what I'm thinking. I think in the game, it's, I mean, I tried some of the tutorial missions, and yes, there is a satisfaction from getting it right and seeing a mission successfully complete, but it's just such faff to get it there. I mean, maybe these concepts haven't sunk in properly, perhaps I haven't played it enough, perhaps it gets better and easier as you go. But so I'm sort of trying to sort of psych myself up to the Orbit Kerbin contract, which is down as 3-star difficulty, and I'm having trouble with 1-star missions at the moment. You know, trying to do this unaided with a rocket of my own design, and I'm just terrified and don't really trust them. I could probably find lots of walkthroughs and just follow them, but I don't know.
Have you considered letting the missions guide you too much and just trying to get science?
Well, it's objectives, isn't it? That's the thing.
Well, you set your own objectives. You just try and get the science to unlock stuff.
It's not really a sandbox game in that sense, though, is it? You've got to pick something and do it and go there, and these contracts seem to be a way of doing that and earning the money you need to actually buy stuff.
They're a way of guiding you, yeah.
But you've got to be earning all these points and stuff to carrying on with the career mode of it all. So, you know, why go immediately to one of the really far out
planets? Are you doing multiple contracts in one launch?
No. I'm definitely not trying to multi-quest on the same mission. That's insane. It's hard enough. I mean, you really do have to... I'm finding you really have to custom design the rocket each time to tick off the specific... I mean, even the observe different places around Kerbin. I mean, some of them are really far away and are going to need a lot more boosting to get the right arc trajectory thing. And then some of them are really quite close, so you don't want to overcook it. I mean, that's very easy to do. I think in the end for that, I ended up with a large booster to get me up and going, and then one of the throttleable rockets, and I was just having so much trouble trying to sort of eyeball and steer so that the arc would end up in the right place. And it doesn't just sit there. You don't get the right ballistic arc appear on the world map, and then you think, right, that's good, I can let this happen now, because they're constantly drifting and moving about, and I don't know why. Whether it's because you're using up fuel, the center of mass is changing, the rocket's weight's changing the whole time, and the planet's turning as well, which I think I'm not thinking about properly. And it's just, I mean, I have a much greater and renewed respect for NASA, but then I always thought it was an extremely insanely difficult thing they were doing anyway. I don't need to see for myself exactly how difficult what they do is, because I believe them, you know.
Yeah,
it's I don't know. I mean, I see, you know, various friends rave about it a lot, and you know, they're always sort of posting screenshots of, hey, look, I've landed on this distant world with this massive multi-stage, you know, sort of like Skylab type object orbiting around like the fourth or fifth planet out, and I'm thinking, wow, you know, well done you, but there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. It's insane. I can't even dock two objects together yet, so there's going to be no chance of building any kind of massive interplanetary thing by launching bits and pieces up to assemble it in orbit. So, I mean, I suppose I could probably practice lots. That's the thing. That's ultimately the problem, is that, yes, it will be easy if I do it lots and lots and lots and lots. This is a game that is absolutely going to reward a lot of dedication, hard work and practice. And I'm just thinking, I can't be asked. That's the problem. It's me. I'm at fault here. The game is fantastic, I'm sure, but I'm not. I'm just too stupid to get this right very easily. I think that's the problem here.
It is a game which...
You've played it a lot. What do you think?
I played it. Yeah, no, I really love the game. It is telling that I haven't played it a lot recently.
Well, quite. Have you gotten to a point where you've managed to successfully land on the moon or something and think, tick, right, I don't have to do this anymore?
Well, you see, when I was playing it, it didn't have all that career mode.
Oh, okay,
I was
right.
Playing when everything was open at the start and you just built missions.
Oh, okay, right. I don't know if that would help or hinder me. I mean, whether if I would just left to putter about with my own devices.
In some ways it helps, because when you can just build whatever you want, you tend to build big, heavy and rubbish.
I don't think there is a sandbox mode that I could tell. That's the problem. I'm
pretty sure there is.
I think it is career mode or tutorials. I'm not sure there is a just do what you like creative mode there at all in the what game I've seen anyway. Perhaps I'm missing an option somewhere, but it would be stupid if there wasn't something like that.
I'm pretty sure there is there somewhere.
Maybe I'm missing an option, yeah. But it certainly steers you into doing it career mode, and career mode sort of keeps these contracts coming. It keeps progressing you up to harder and harder, more difficult things, I suppose, you know.
Yeah, you have to sort of plug away up until you get the useful bits. And once you've got the useful bits, it all gets a lot easier.
Well, I'm looking at the technology I've unlocked now, which is pretty much everything that you see already in the tutorial. And there's still loads and loads of more advanced tech tree items available to unlock. And I'm thinking, well, am I going to need any of this stuff for?
Well, because it's better engines, yeah, and I suppose. Things. And the entire space plane thing is so much
Space planes, right. Well, that was, as you say, that would, I don't know, would that make it easier to visit these places?
Yeah, and
oh, because you could just cruise at the altitude you need and just fly
over
the
top. Yeah, it's just a plane.
You don't have to land there, no.
Yeah, you can even land. You can land these planes.
Oh, do you need flat ground? Is it runways?
No, you can land just about anywhere as long as you're good enough.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's an interesting game, and it is one that I do feel has, over the years, made its barrier to entry be harder than it should be.
I don't know.
Possibly by them trying to make it easier.
I don't know what you'd do to make it more accessible without destroying what it is. That's the problem. And utterly infuriating all the people who do like it. There's not much I could think of that would make life easier there. The tutorial missions are there and they're interesting and they're well put together, but they are, it's not, you know, just push forward and then I'll tell you about the next thing. It's do some complicated stuff. And you have to keep, you really have to be on the ball with the tutorials as well. You know, I mean, I suppose, you know, this is me. This is the modern gaming age, which makes idiots of us all. But this is a game that really does, even in the tutorial, need you to be sharp, need you to be paying attention, need you to do the right things and well. You know, this is about dexterity. Manual burns. God, why? Why is that even a thing? I can't imagine. Yeah, is that how they really work in NASA? Yeah, a bloke in the top of the rocket has a lever and has to pull the lever when the countdown finishes and push the lever when this other countdown finishes.
Sometimes, yes.
That's insane. If you take, we have computers.
Take a look at Apollo 11.
Millisecond perfect.
Look
computers.
At Apollo 11 when they were landing.
Yeah,
and they had to take over control and do a manual landing because it was going wrong.
That's as maybe in 1960 whatever. But I just, you know, I mean, it just seems mind-boggling that a space program would have that level of manual input at all.
Well, you got to remember that the Kerbals are discovering space travel before they've got any other form of technology.
Well, yeah, I mean, there needs to be some sort... Yeah, I can understand from a game perspective there needs to be some kind of hands-on thing, but every time I'm required to use hands-on things to get anything done in that game, I do really badly and Kerbals die. And I'm just thinking, this is not very scientific at all. Let's just eyeball it. That's the sort of thing you do in X-Wing. That's the sort of thing you do in Elite Dangerous. And those are not space exploration simulators. Those are high fantasy space opera shoot-em-ups.
So I'm going to make a note here that in the situation where we're trapped on the spaceship, then you're going to be no use because you're going to fall to pieces the moment the computers fail.
Absolutely. Houston, we have a problem. I'm not going to be the man. Can anyone aboard fly a spaceship? No. But it is fascinating. It is interesting from a sort of detached... quasi-educational perspective and sort of starting to understand the speeds and distances and the sorts of timescales involved in real space exploration, yeah. You know, that what's actually going on now where we're putting probes in orbit around Saturn and stuff.
You also know what periapsis means.
Well, yes. Is that the near one or the far one?
That was one of the two.
Yeah, so that's the kind of mistake that will get you killed very easily. But yes. Oh, yeah, the terminology is interesting. But for me, it's fascinating seeing exactly how primitive and crude we are at exploring space, because pretty much I steep my entire life in trashy science fiction space opera stuff where it's all hyperspace and portals and wormholes and all sorts of, you know, and even the finger quotes hard SF is generally about ram scoop drives and, you know, basically by hard SF they mean not faster than light. So they mean people having to sleep in pods for 10 years.
It's not faster than light but still quick enough to not be boring.
Still bonkers and magical and pixie dust compared to what goes on in Kerbal Space Program, which is essentially put a bloke on top of a very big firework and fire it for just long enough in just the right direction, and in about 3 years you might actually land on a different planet, but you know, we couldn't guarantee anything. It's so primitive and crude what our space travel and our space exploration actually amounts to when you look at it laid out for you in say something like Kerbal Space Program, which is a game, is got little gonk-headed cute people in the cockpit, and they don't have oxygen, they don't need food and water, better. And there's a lot
which
of
is lucky.
There's a lot of things that
the number
you know,
of ones I've got stuck in a solar orbit.
There's a lot of things that aren't real in Kerbal, but it's still by far the most realistic space thing I've ever seen on a computer game. And I'm starting to see and appreciate and understand, how vast and how vast the universe is, and B, how useless we are at space travel.
Yeah.
You know, so I suppose it was interesting from that perspective, which in itself is a little bleak. But as a game, I don't know, I'm finding it quite hard work, and that's putting me off wanting to actually play it. You know, I see the desktop icon, and I think, yeah, I should play some more Kerbal Space Program. And then I'll double-click on X Rebirth and just, you know, build a few more star bases and go portal jumping between made-up alien planets and shooting people with my lasers and whatever, because it's just a lot easier and more fun.
Well, what I would suggest
is this me? Am I just lazy now?
You are lazy now.
Have I conditioned myself not to enjoy difficult experiences?
There's two things. One, it being you, you're ignoring the fact there's lots of people telling you how to play on YouTube.
Well, what's the point in that? I can follow some YouTube walkthroughs. Well, you know, that's like doing a jigsaw puzzle, isn't it? Really,
it's not playing
a game. I could just read a book. That's a walkthrough of someone else's story and play.
I think you'll find that you're quite close to it clicking.
Well, maybe. I will play more, but
Once you've got the hang of the basics, the manoeuvres and everything, maybe install MechJeb or something.
I'm just wondering if... I shouldn't need mods, you know? I mean, yeah, okay, I appreciate there's probably quite a useful mod scene out there, and I expect if I look around, there'll be a list of the 12 must-have mods for Kerbal and all the rest of it. But if they must-have mods, why doesn't the base game do this?
Yeah, that's
anyway,
a good point. Yeah,
I don't hold with other people doing mods to make the game playable as a useful solution to anything, really. It is playable. It's just very difficult and probably very rewarding if it does click and you get it and you do well. But it's a very high activation energy involved in getting myself to actually play Kerbal, you know. And that was part of the reason I'd actually bought Kerbal like sometime mid last year.
You got it when you got Space Engineers.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it was on special,
that, yeah.
And I installed it and it was sat on my desktop. And this very premonitionary activation energy had made me not want to bother starting it because it just felt like it was going to be really hard work. And it turns out I was right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I'll keep going. Maybe it will click. Maybe I'll have some glowing review for you on a future What We're Playing show. But for the moment, I'm just finding it a lot of faff and quite hard work and a bit of an uphill struggle, really.
All I'm going to say here is,
yeah,
you know who you are, tweet him.
Yeah, I expect I'll get comments, but anyway, I call it like I see it. Why don't you talk about a thing?
Do you want to hear about the FMV game The Bunker or The Return of Anna?
I don't even know what that second one is. Let's just talk about The Bunker.
You know what the second one is.
Do I?
Anna. We did a whole video on Anna.
Anna's back.
Let's start with The Bunker.
All right.
Before we get on to Forza Horizon 3.
Yeah.
Yes, The Bunker. The Bunker is an FMV game.
Yes.
Starring a guy called Adam Brown.
Okay.
Who is probably best known for...
Best known. You had to pull up his IMDb page.
Yeah, for playing Oswald Potter in Chucklevision.
Chucklevision. Okay. I'm not sure I like where this is going.
He was also someone called Ori in The Hobbit, but...
he's one of the dwarves.
Nobody of time to remember any of the dwarves.
Nobody knows. There were far too many dwarves in The Hobbit.
The only dwarves I remember from The Hobbit are... You've got Guy of Gisborne.
There's James Nesbitt.
Oh, yeah, you've got James Nesbitt, bizarrely.
An actor I recognised.
Yeah, and then I get on to thinking the Lord of the Rings, and no, that was Gimli, and he was in Lord of the Rings.
Gimli wasn't even in that one, yeah.
So anyway, yes, this is a fully FMV game.
Okay.
Absolutely no CGI at all, as far as I can tell.
Wow.
Filmed...
The 90s are calling, they want their CD-ROMs back.
Filmed in a real nuclear bunker.
Yes.
Decommissioned nuclear bunker that still looks like, you know, the you know that nuclear bunker 50s to 80s could be any time in that period.
A lot of grey concrete, yeah.
Yeah, and that sort of bluish... Yeah, anyway.
We're not going to need home furnishings after the apocalypse.
And you are there, you are... effectively the last survivor in the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
You were born in the bunker when the bombs went off in nuclear war.
Yeah.
And you're now the last survivor in the bunker.
Oh, this is all sounding a bit Fallout.
You have to follow the routine.
Right.
It's vitally important you follow the routine. Every day you have to take your vitamin pills. You have to check your radiation levels.
Uh-huh.
You have to check the radio. You have to have some food and you have to go take care of your mother.
This is all starting to sound a bit grim and bleak.
Yeah, and you do that, and if anything goes wrong, you must never leave your room, and don't go to another level, whatever you do. And you'll be fine as long as nothing goes wrong.
Is this some weird psychological experiment in how long you'll obey arbitrary orders?
No. Very quickly, something goes wrong, okay. And you have to go to another level, and then you have to basically do a bunch of things to try and repair the site. The game only lasts about 2 hours.
Okay.
But it is fully F&B. You remember me talking about the David Cage games, the thingy.
Hard Rain was one.
Heavy Rain. And all those, you know, where it does stuff like we've got to do lots and lots of movements to do things.
Yeah.
It's sort of like that, but really pared down, so it's not annoying. So you'll click on where you want to go on the screen. It's sort of a point-and-click adventure in places. If you want to open a door, sometimes you'll have to click and drag something to... make him open the handle.
So you're sort of talking gestures to trigger new clips of video, effectively.
Sort of, yeah. And you're basically doing things that, you know, to start off with, you have to replace a fuse in the fuse box to get the computers back up and running.
Okay.
And there's some fantastic computers. There's a Commodore 64 in there they're using. There's an Amstrad PCW they're bizarrely using. it's really quite fantastic from that point of view. And you basically... work through a not very branchy story. It's very linear.
It's not going to be very branchy if you've got bits of video for every action you do.
I've only played it the one time, so I don't know exactly where any branching points are up until the end, which has a blatant one, which, as you can expect, will be the one where you decide to do one thing or the other, which, you know, the game has to have. And I don't know if elsewhere there's any chance to not have things happen. But there's a... I want to be careful of spoilers here. There's a bit with some blood.
Right.
There's a bit where blood happens. Okay. I don't know if it's possible to avoid the blood happening.
Okay.
Actually, the blood's an important point.
I suppose you could theoretically grab around in the resource files and find out how many clips of video are there.
Yeah, but... I could do. Or I could just probably look online if
I actually probably it's documented somewhere.
I only finished playing it just before you got in. Literally
wow, cutting edge.
The blood's an interesting point. It's a fully FMV game.
Yeah.
And so if any injuries were to occur in the game, like, say, bones protruding through skin.
Ew.
Exactly. You know how you have that nice detachment in normal games?
So we're starting on the other side of the Uncanny Valley from the get-go.
We're way past the Uncanny Valley, and we're in the whole, actually, this has to be rated properly if you're going to actually consider
Does
this.
Does it have a BBFC rating and all the rest of it?
I don't think it needs one.
Oh.
Because it hasn't released as
technically a film.
Oh no, it's released on PS4, so it may well do.
Okay.
It's probably an 18.
Yeah, fair enough. It's an interesting thing there. So you're sort of basically talking essentially a choose your, how much game agency do you have? If this is essentially a choose your own adventure, is it literally click here for option one or click here for option two?
Well, you see that.
Or is there any kind of interaction that goes beyond that? Because that's going to be a real nightmare to do in terms of actual video. If the entire thing is, it's entirely FMV, it's not like menus.
Yeah.
You don't come out for the little puzzle block game and go back into a proper CG. If the entire thing is literally a film, we're almost back to sort of Dragon's Lair sort of thing.
Well, it's not so much
Dragon's Lair wasn't a terribly interactive game at all.
Yeah, but Dragon's Lair had lots of failable QuickTime events. This has very few failable QuickTime events.
So in what sense does the gameplay mechanics manifest? How do you control
You're basically
things?
Just following a story.
Yeah, and every so often you make a choice between one or the other.
I only encountered one choice.
So there's not even any
at
choices?
At the very end, there was one choice.
So can it be said that there's any gameplay at all? This is always, you know, it's a good old chat, but you know, come back to again and again. But
is it just a story? Is it an experience?
In what
is
sense are you not just watching a two-hour film?
Because you are... the making you do things makes... it feel more involved.
But there's no choice. So literally it's push button to carry on, push button to carry on, push button to carry on.
Yeah, but there are some points when you think, oh, do I really want to push this? And
well, then
it forces you to.
You don't have the option of doing anything else.
No, you don't have a choice of doing anything.
This is not sounding that great at all then, to be honest.
But it is. But that's the thing. It is absolutely fantastic.
Is it this is art.
Not art. Don't pull the is it art thing again.
Well, it's not a game, is it?
No, it is. Oh, don't pull the is it a game thing either.
Well, it sounds like you don't really do much.
It's Kerbal a game
with it. Well, Kerbal's a game in that you have lots of interactivity and you have a win condition and outcome that you're trying to achieve, and
which
you can or you can do it or you can fail. But it sounds like this thing. I'll have to watch you actually playing some of this because I don't. Not sure I fully understand.
Well, it is purely a bit of interactive fiction.
But even interactive, it sounds like you're not. How is it interactive? You got one choice at the end, you say, and
yeah, but throughout all the time you are doing things, and it does draw you in. The mere act of having to do things draws you into the story more.
Okay.
The fact of you having to work through
what
the
is to doing things. What do you do?
Oh well, you're fixing things mainly.
So the fuse box, you push button to fix fuse.
No, you have to go find the bits because you know it's sort of like.
So you can actually travel around a non-linear.
Oh yeah, no, you can move around. You've got complete agency of moving around.
Right. So you've got locations you can go to in the order you choose.
It's very much like a David Cage thing. Yeah.
You use the video for transitions between different places. Yeah,
So you know you need to go do this. So you have to find the manual to do it. You have to go, then you have to go reset the fuse.
From the way you're describing it, I thought you just had literally it was just happening and every so often you push continue.
No.
Okay.
Although. It's a very small map.
Yeah.
Because it's set in a very small bunker.
Mm-hmm. Well, that setting works well for the medium, which if you've got to do full video for everything.
And it doesn't spend a lot of time at all telling you to go to the other side of the map to fetch something and come back.
Yeah.
Because that would be really annoying. Not
quite so artificial in that regard, then.
Yeah. You know how. Firewatch, great example from earlier in the year, where at the very end, it literally makes you on the other side of the map from where you need to be for the last bit.
Yeah.
And so your last memory of travelling in the game is crossing the entire map just because it wanted to show off the fact that stuff was on fire.
Yeah. Setting up for a big finish, I suppose. Yeah.
So this is. You definitely have. If you go into it expecting it to be Fallout.
Well, the premise sounds quite similar.
Okay. Let's compare it to Fallout. Fallout has way more interaction, but zero meaning, terrible storytelling, terrible delivery.
Fallout's not even in the bunker either. In any of the games, the bunker it basically starts with you being thrown out of the bunker for reason whatever.
Oh, you end up going to a bunker because it has to make a moral. You have to show which particular experiment they're doing in each one. And the latest one, there's one where you make a bunker. But anyway.
Yeah.
But whereas this is a nice, tight story told inside the bunker about what happens to everybody and you trying to deal with the fact that you're the last person there and trying to deal with the fact that everything's falling to bits.
Mm-hmm. So if it's all a big FMV experience, I suppose we need to bring some degree of film review into the
yes,
the process.
We definitely do.
So how are the performances then, the people, the actors involved?
Well,
does this work well? Does the medium...
The names you'll know and is Adam Brown and not that one, Sarah Green.
Okay. Different Sarah Green.
Yeah, from Penny Dreadful, not from Blue Peter.
The '80s.
And the '80s. And 80s early morning Saturday TV.
Mm-hmm.
And their performances are fantastic. It is really well shot. The location is fantastic and looks. You would have to spend a small fortune to make a set that good.
So clearly filmed on location.
Filmed on location in the real.
In one of the
real abandoned secret bunkers that have signs nowadays. So
that helps. That must help an awful lot, yeah.
It looks gorgeous. It's lit well.
HD?
Yeah.
Okay,
cool.
That was the big problem with FMV in the 90s, is it was...
Well, that's it.
The disk space involved meant that it was always like a tiny, tiny window with really fuzzy sort of multi-scan lines and all the rest
of it. That's really it now. It is basically an interactive film.
Yes.
It's as long as a film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interactive.
So if your experiences of FMV are just that little letterbox format from like early Wing Commander games, then this is probably going to be something new.
Yeah, I think it definitely is a game, but it's also a interesting new type of film.
Yeah.
And there's a Venn diagram there which has that in the middle.
I'm always a bit dubious about that Venn diagram intersection, but perhaps I'll see one that convinces me it can be done
well. In this case,
I
think it does work, and I think that you could probably get... I would like to get someone... who is more into films and not into games to play it. I mean,
should rope in some of the hosts off your old film podcast thing.
They all play games.
You mean you want someone who doesn't...
Mark Komodo.
Somebody who's not really playing... Someone not doesn't play games a lot, not steeped in that side of things. Someone
because
pure
some
film
of the twists in
go.
It become quite... Especially, well, there are some bits in the plot about what happened and what happened to people and...
How does that work in terms of movie pacing and so on? Yeah.
Because there was a dawning realisation in it that I should have realised something a lot earlier. because computer games, and which it may have deflected me from because it was more like a film.
Okay. So it sort of challenges the expectations a bit.
It's a fascinating example, and it's one that I really do enjoy. And I think that it is worth playing. Okay, it's something like a tenner for 2 hours play, but that's fiver an hour. That's two pints.
You're sort of comparing that against actual movie prices, really.
And it is an interactive movie, and it is done using computer game language and terminology, and it is very interesting, and I recommend playing it.
Yeah, I might have to give this a go just so that I can come back with some sort of ornery, contrary opinion and dismiss it as rubbish from a position of authority. But it sounds like it is actually an interesting attempt to sort of cross the span the media again. And we see that every so often. And then
it's the second FMV game I've played in the last year, which I've really liked.
Are you thinking of Her Story? Yeah. Was the other one. Yeah.
Which, again, used a very, very interesting conceit of a plot device, which was a corrupted police interview database to find clips using search for what was said.
Yeah.
And to try, and that used a non-linear narrative to tell a story.
It's quite heavy on the exploration gameplay in that fashion. Yeah. But,
this is a lot more heavy on the actual narrative gameplay.
Yeah, so it's much more of a straight start to end type experience. Yeah. Yeah, sounds interesting, certainly.
Definitely.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Guild Wars 2. We Tuesday New Club are back in action in an MMO again.
Wow.
It's been a while. Yeah, well, we've taken summer off from... I can't even remember what we were playing last. I think it might have been a Planetside 2 jaunt most recently. But not a lot going on over the summer, apart from our Tabletop Simulator Fridays, which we're still doing. I think it was... We were playing Blood Bowl Team Manager this Friday, which works quite well in Tabletop Simulator.
Just being killed as a game.
Oh dear, that's a shame. Well, it'll live on in our hearts and memories.
Fantasy Flight lost the rights for Games Workshop, so the game is dying as of February.
Well, they can't.
Must buy the expansion.
They're not going to recall all the existing copies so they probably can still sell the one they got. But
have to stop selling stuff after February.
Oh, fair enough. Anyway, so we casted around, and I think there was talk about Secret World, and that might still happen. But for some reason, a couple of us found ourselves just dabbling around with Guild Wars 2, and I can't remember why I burnt out of it. I should probably go back and listen to some podcasts from the time. But I imagine it was the railroading of the story and we'd reached 80 and it was all getting a bit samey. And also, the OR, the region in the game, is a particularly difficult set of zones where it's just a nightmare getting from A to B. Anyway, I sort of started up a new character, jumping around as a thief and just sort of stabbing stuff, running around the countryside, doing the little heart quests and stuff. And I'm thinking, actually, this is probably pretty useful for what we want. It's the usual, you know, regular listeners will definitely know the usual three questions that you apply to an MMO is how many people are in the team size and how many friends have you got? If that number is the same, then well done, you're quite lucky. Do all of your friends instinctively like to divide themselves into one of three classes on proportions of roughly 1, 1, and 3 based on DPS, tanking and healing? If so, then again, well done, you're very lucky. And do all of your friends have exactly the same amount of time to play on this game? If so, again, you're very lucky.
It's highly unlikely.
Yeah, most MMOs are designed for people who have precisely 4 friends, 2 of whom like to do damage, and one of whom likes to heal, and one of whom likes to tank, and who will only ever play exactly the same 4 hours a week.
Yeah.
And so on, and none of them will ever get bored either. But for the rest of us, we constantly have this struggle where we're just looking for MMOs that support our requirements, which essentially is a group of about, it varies from 5 through to about 13 players. Pretty much all of whom like playing different classes whenever they like, and some of whom only play 1 hour a week, and some of whom play like 30 hours a week. So, you know, a game that ticks all those boxes is one that we can sign up with, we can get behind, and it turns out actually Guild Wars 2 does do this. It solves the level problem by making everybody the same level as the content that they're around.
Yeah.
So you travel around the world and it will just lower your level to match wherever you are, which functionally means that everyone gets to be as useful as everyone else in a given place. The barrier there is that it won't level you up. If you've not actually done the work and got the levels to get to the further end content, then you just have to go back to the old stuff and do it again. But it does have 4 or 5 different paths through the content, which is nice. There's basically 5 races, and they each get their starter areas, and then those starter areas merge as they go up. But there's still even at level 80 and 70 and so on, there's still about three or four different zones you can be in. So there's, and you get the same loot for, you get your own level appropriate loot and rewards for, even if you're mucking around in the level 10 zone or whatever. So that basically means that there's always something for anyone in any part of the world once they've unlocked it by becoming the appropriate level. So that works. Guild Wars is one of these action MMOs. Here's my weary sigh. It basically, if you're standing still in that game, you're doing it wrong and are about to be punished extensively. You need to be tumbling and moving all the time. But the consequence of that is it doesn't have the static Trinity gameplay where a bloke in all the armour stands at the front and makes everything cross at it and then everyone else sort of hides behind that person. You know, everyone in Guild Wars 2 is essentially a kind of ranged or melee DPS with AoE buffing and AoE damage and a self-heal. So you sort of, you can jiggle it about a bit within the class specs to be a bit more group friendly or a bit less group friendly, but ultimately everyone is responsible for keeping themselves alive and everyone's out there doing damage. There's not really tanking in that sense in the game, well, not that I've found. I mean, there's some 5-man dungeons in there, and I still haven't quite worked out how those are supposed to go, but I imagine it's just a massive DPS race and everyone tumbling all the time.
Yeah.
Don't stand in the red circle is far more important than don't draw aggro in that game. And then the amount of time played, well, again, that's a function of the levels and so on. So we've basically kicked off with the Tuesday Noob Club again. Of Legend of Old. It was originally a Guild Wars 1 thing. We're doing it in Guild Wars 2 now. So, yeah, we had, I think we had about 11 or so people turn up at the most recent week, and that was fantastic. We've done that, we've been doing it for about 2 weeks now. I think we went with a comedy concept guild. We're all tree people, we're all Silvari, which leads to all sorts of strange questions about, you know, can tree people eat meat? You know, how's the pollen work? There's a lot of biology that we're puzzling and trying to work out. We're basically, because the content in Guild Wars 2, you don't have a quest journal. There are no quests. There's no, you know, exclamation mark over the head type thing. Basically, the entire game runs off public quests. You just go to a region and there'll be a little heart will appear in the corner on the top of the HUD. And that will give you, typically you end up with three or four different tasks that you can do to make that heart go up, basically impress the local people. At least two or three of those will be kill stuff. But often they'll be go and pick up things or go and feed flowers or, you know, go and you know, gather eggs or whatever. You know, there'll usually be some. I mean, it makes me wonder if there's a pacifist playthrough concept available there, if it's possible to play, get to level 80 without killing anything at all. You get XP for all sorts of things in there. You get XP for harvesting, for crafting, XP for rezzing other players and rezzing NPCs as well. So you could, I suppose, theoretically get to max level without killing anything, although there'll be so much having to run away from stuff because otherwise you end up killing it in self-defense. It's a very angry world where everything's trying to kill you. But, so again, that whole heart mechanic in the, you don't have a series of quests of your own you're trying to sort of work out and synchronize steps. Again, that works very well for the way we sort of steamroll around MMO zones, murdering everything in our path.
Yeah.
It's in fact, that kind of approach is positively rewarded in Guild Wars 2 because often you'll find veteran monsters or champion monsters are a bit harder or aimed at groups and stuff, and just having a couple of people nearby also wailing on it all tends to help as well. So it's all good. I think we'll do quite well. I think it'll be, you know, it'll be the usual problem of will we run out of steam, will we get bored, and will we make it to 80? But certainly the last couple of weeks have been anything to go by. We're having a ball. It seems quite flexible in terms of server guesting as well. We've had a couple of people who the problem with Guild Wars 2 is that you create your character on a server and then all your characters are on that server as well.
Yeah.
And you can't server transfer individual characters.
That's annoying.
You have to do the whole lot or not at all.
That's really annoying.
But they do have a guest feature where you can just join join across to the other server. I think it won't let you participate in World v World if you're not originally from that server, because that's the World v World teams are effectively servers. Yeah. But then Guild Wars 2 is such a sort of interlayered instanced thing that the idea of servers is a bit quaint anyway. It doesn't really mean much apart from whose team you're on in World v World. So I don't know if we'll be doing that. I mean, you know, there's varying levels of enthusiasm regarding PvP in our group. I imagine we'll try some World v World stuff, but I can't imagine it'll be a main focus for us. There's a lot of large-scale sort of group stuff near the high end that we're looking forward to doing, though. Most of the zones have a kind of meta public quest event chain thing going on as well. Most of the time there'll be a sidebar thing saying such and such is quiet at the moment, but every so often, sort of on a sort of couple of hourly timers, things will get big. You know, these giant monsters will start appearing, and then there'll be like a massive, quite often very spectacular fight involving sort of multiple groups, effectively mini sort of overland raids that go on, that engage and involve everyone in the zone to come pitch in and, you know, appropriate rewards and so on. They are general. I mean, I unfortunately haven't got any video of any of that at the moment, but as we get to that kind of place, and after try and remember to record some, because they are fantastically elaborate giant monster set pieces, you know, monsters with different targetable parts, their hands have got crosshairs on, you have to blow them up, then there'll be waves of ads, and you've got do other things to make it vulnerable. Yeah, real sort of massive camaraderie thing going on there, and it's definitely a spectacle, definitely worth seeing. Trouble is, that sort of stuff doesn't really come in large quantities and frequency until much later in the game, so we have to do the sort of lower end stuff a bit first. I think that's reasonable, though, to let people get the hang of classes. I'm trying something new this time. I'm a warrior this time. I've not done one of those, which largely seems to be, as you'd imagine, melee DPS, but there's a fair bit of team buff stuff going on as well. You have the warrior dump banners on the ground, which give AoE buffs to various stats, or you can have them shout out things that buff everyone around as well. So they're quite a good support class if you spec them right, as well as the obvious straight solo DPS variants of it all. Yeah, quite a few changes since I've been in there last. I think I was there before Heart of Thorns. I think the Living World thing's still going on. I'm quite ambivalent to the Living World. That might put me off. That might have been responsible for me giving it up last time. This constant, hey, come and look at our big thing.
Yeah.
It's very much the case of an MMO company wanting to dictate how I use their product, when in fact I'll say how I use it, thank you. I just want a place to happen in. I don't really necessarily, not that interested in massive ongoing world stories that I need to slavishly keep logging in and taking part in every week just to keep up with. And now I've sort of fallen off of that. It's a big relief. You know, I gave up when Living World for Season 1 was around. You can't do that now. That's content that will never come back. It was all big in-game stuff, large events, big NPC villains and so on. And it was probably a lot of fun if you were invested in it and you bought into it and you carried on and tagged along with it every week, you know, religiously. But from subsequent Living World seasons, I think they're on Season 3 now. Season 2 they've made available to buy and is more of a personal story type quest chain thing, apparently. Season 3 is happening at the moment, where I think they've just added the Ring of Fire, a whole new series of volcanic island zones that fans of Guild Wars 1 will remember. That's all gone in recently. I've only just discovered the Maguma Wastes, actually, which is the stuff that went in most recently prior to all that when I wasn't there. I was trying some of that today. The Silver Wastes zone is interesting. That's a level 80 zone, and that is massive. Basically, it seems to be a kind of PvE World v World zone. You've got this big enemy villain force called the Mordrin, which are like giant evil plant things that are trying to destroy the entire zone, and it essentially ends up with you and the Mordrin, you being all of the players, working together to try and fight them back to their end of the zone. And there's a series of fortresses all the way along and supply caravans, and each of those generates their own little missions and activities and so on. You get renown and so on for taking part of it. But the idea is that as a zone, you're supposed to try and secure and hold four of these fortresses against regular timed invasions. And presumably when that happens, a thing happens, or some access to some end zone thing happens, you can go and actually attack the Mordrin thing itself. And I guess if you do that, then it's a massive heroic thing. But as a solo player, it's a pretty hard work zone, because you're just getting steamrolled by scripted invasions aimed at groups of players the whole time. So, it's an interesting place to explore, but I'm looking forward to us getting there as a large team and we can just swarm around and use the place as designed. Also, I had a look at a place called Drytop, which is another sort of fairly recent zone. That one seems to be a kind of linear zone-wide jumpy puzzle with, I don't really know, there's all sorts of strange glowing crystal things you pick up which give you super jump powers or teleport powers, and you're supposed to use those to make your way across the zone. But there's, again, lots of group-based event type things happening all the way around there, and I only usually dip my toe in there, so looking forward to seeing what that's about. But it seems a bit more of a linear unlock and jump your way along the zone type puzzle. Interesting anyway. and came across a big whirly that had a big no entry symbol on, and I tried to go in, and it opened up the shop page for Heart of Thorns, which I don't have. Not many of us in the Tutored New Club have it, and I predict it's going to be quite a long time before we need it. Heart of Thorns is a proper expansion. It's a full price expansion as well. It's like 40 quid's worth. It unlocks various advanced mechanics, masteries, which I think are post level 80 additional character development. There's a whole new class called a Revenant, which you can only play if you've got Heart of Thorns. But most of the Heart of Thorns stuff, from what I can tell, seems to be post 80 content. I'm not worried about that, and at the moment, certainly members of the Tuesday New Club don't need to worry about having that or not. But when we get to 80, we can have a big old chat about whether it's worth us all getting that and going for it. I think if you got Heart of Thorns, you can unlock Guild Halls, which we never really had the first time round. But then, Guild Hall. How useful is a Guild Hall, really?
Yeah.
it's a nice thing to look at once or twice, but it rarely sees daily use in any game I've ever played, so who knows. But yeah, I'm really, really optimistic about how this is all going. I'm getting the hang of the Warrior. It's not quite as intuitive as the Mesmer, but there's a lot less tumbling about involved, because Warrior's a heavier class that can take a lot more battering. So perhaps I'll get less irritated by the dodge that level 80 mesmering constantly seemed to be. I don't know. Seems to be going well. We'll see how popular it remains as the weeks go on. But I think we've got enough to get at least a group to the end.
That's cool.
Possibly more. But yeah. If folks are interested in joining up, then follow the various trail of breadcrumb clues to find out how to get to the Slack group. And
go to the website. There's a link.
There's a website. There's a link. We've got a Slack channel. Introduce yourself in there. There's a Mumble channel. And Tuesdays, 8 p.m. UK time. We're on Pick and Square server, but with the guesting, that needn't necessarily be an issue. So yeah, it's good to be back in playing with the gang again. You know,
cool.
I'm enjoying it. It's gonna be good. Okay, over to you.
I'm going to talk about Forza Horizon 3.
Forza Horizon 3,
which is like Forza Horizon 1 or 2, but has a 3 on the end.
Has a 3 on the end,
and it's set in Australia.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So instead of being set with the first one was America, mm-hmm. Around Utah and various places, I think, and the second one was in the Mediterranean. France, Italy. Around.
Is that the sort of open world drive along every road type game? I'm thinking of something else.
Yeah, no, it was the one with Anna, where we shouted Anna at her.
Anna, yes. Yeah. Oh, that's right, your voice-activated sat-nav, yes.
I haven't turned her on yet, because my Kinect is not connected to my Xbox. yeah, and this is, without wanting to spoil anything, possibly the best racing game on any console.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay,
it's a bit more arcadey than Sim, but just the amount of content you get, the pure joy of driving in it, and just how fun the game is,
mm-hmm.
I think that it really does win out. It's the usual affair of in this one it's a bit more involved, because you're building up all of the different events. So you start with one festival, which unlocks a bunch of events around it, and each event you complete has a new fans XP, so the number of fans you have.
Okay, so
and the
a
more
sort
fans
of,
you get, the more you can expand.
So a sort of progression thing going on there.
So you've got cash as a progression thing. Can you afford the car?
Yeah.
You've got XP. What level are you?
Yeah.
And you've also got how many fans you got. How big is the events?
Okay.
And the events thing just take care of themselves.
And that sort of provides a sort of framing device for the sort of just go everywhere, do everything.
Yeah.
You've got the various events going on within the overall massive world as well. So I suppose a lot of it is driving between the places. And,
yeah. Although the world's not as big as it seems. The world seems big, but it's not overly big.
It can be too big, these things, yeah.
Yeah, so it never takes too... If you need to go from one corner of the map to the other, it's not too bad.
Yeah.
Fast travel? There is fast travel in it, yeah.
Move between.
Yeah, in the same way as in previous ones, there are fast travel boards you can unlock to reduce costs and stuff, and unlock fast travel between bits, and eventually, I presume, you just unlock fast travel between everything.
Okay.
There's the usual types of events. There's the races and stuff.
Bread and butter, yeah.
Speed cameras. There's jumps now.
Okay.
So there's danger signs, which basically are just jumps.
Okay, yeah.
And so you get distance on them. Each event you do, well, a lot of events you do now gives you a number of stars depending on how well you did.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them you'll have to just keep trying them until you get...
Yeah, refining the event, getting better and better, yeah.
Also, some of your early cars are not going to do...
If at first you don't succeed, go away, come back with a better car. Yeah.
Because there's an awful lot of off-road and on-road.
Yeah.
If you can imagine being Australia, there's a lovely surf town.
Yeah.
A nice city with lots of roads, but there's also the proper outback.
Oh, good.
And also the rainforest with
lots of
trees. It's
a bit Mad Max in places.
Yeah. The rainforest has a hell of a lot of trees. The woods actually feel woody.
That's a surprising thing. Seeing proper forest in any computer game is actually surprisingly rare. It's all done with trickery usually.
Yeah, well, it's getting to the point now where you can just do it. There is enough processing power there, and people have understood instancing and various things to make it happen. And this does it quite well. You do feel like there's
speed tree trees.
There is a fantastic road you're going along, which is basically a hollow way. So you know it's dug down into the dirt a bit, and so there's high banks at the either side and just lined with trees and forests on either side, and it's just fantastic. You're driving along there in sunset, the lighting's fantastic. This game is gorgeous.
Yeah, it sounds good.
It absolutely does push the Xbox One, as far as I can tell, as far as it can go.
Is this where Burnout Paradise has gone now, is it really?
Or... No, you see, everyone's comparing it to Burnout Paradise, but that's completely wrong. It's more a comparison with Test Drive Unlimited. Burnout Paradise was... It was a very specific set of controlled routes.
Yes.
And very arcadey driving.
Yeah.
And it's nothing like this. This feels completely open. There's one bit where I was driving down a road, I was mapping all the roads to annoy someone. And I got to the end of the road and I thought, going down this long gully, thinking, actually, this doesn't seem to end. I'm going to see if I can get through and push through to the... telescope array over there, and you can just drive through, because if you remember you probably don't, but in the original two games, first one especially, lots and lots of cordoned off areas because they didn't want you to have full roam, because there just wasn't enough memory to hold it.
Okay.
And I think this one has got around a lot of that now and doesn't matter as much.
Yeah, so better hardware and so on.
There's a lot less walls that just stop you getting to areas, and if you want to go between A and B, the straightest line usually is a viable
That's an important breakthrough then, isn't it? Because you're getting more closer and closer to a sort of, I don't know, Google Earth, just in a car type experience.
Yes.
Which is the ultimate sandbox for driving, the ultimate freedom to drive wherever you like. It sounds compelling.
I was doing that A to B thing on one race. I needed to get to a point. I came careening about 45 degrees off angle from where the road would have gone.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I ran out of land that I realised that the end point was actually massive bridge.
Not going to hit an invisible wall or anything.
And I was, and then I was in water and not high enough to make it. Yeah. It's fantastic in that way. It really does feel like you have full control over where you're driving. And I like the way that they've now got you building up the festival. Because you start with just one location with only a couple of events. And then once you get enough fans, you can upgrade that one. Then you get more fans. You can build a second festival. You choose which one you want. Do you want the one in the city or do you want the one in the outback?
Okay.
It tells you how many percentage of people chose which as well, which is interesting. I'm not entirely sure what that says, but everyone chooses the city, apparently. No one wants the outback. And you just basically... pull up more and more events around you, and this whole fans XP is completely a sham, because all it's doing is give you enough XP to get to a point where you unlock more things, give you more XP.
It's a sort of early game rationing, rather than, I suppose, studies have been done that show perhaps that players get paralysed by utter freedom if it's all there straight away.
I think it's there to mean you've got 300 events on this map. Oh dear, not going to be able to do anything.
Well, don't do them all at once. Try doing them in this order here.
Here's three or four to start with and work up from there. And you unlock them all. So it's your
Structure.
It's your responsibility because they're there.
That kind of structure probably is useful, in most cases.
There's bucket lists again, which is basically you go to a location, there's a iconic car of some kind, and and you just basically have to do something, do a jump of it in sunrise. And just it's usually an opportunity for a nice photo or something.
There's a screenshot moment.
There's signature events, which are the stupid event ones, one of the early ones is you're racing a freight train, and a couple of times you have to jump over the freight train, which, just fun.
Why not? Try jumping through it when it has the open doors for facing each other.
Doesn't quite have that.
Oh.
There's barn finds, you know, where it says there's it gives you an area on the map and you have to go in there and you have to find a specific barn. So you then find a car which unlocks.
Oh, stealing people's cars from barns again. Brilliant.
Yeah. Which is fantastic. One of them is a Reliant. Was it Reliant Regal? Not the Robin.
Not the Robin.
Yeah. But yeah, because the Robin is actually the one everyone thinks. But anyway, yeah, so I was souping that up and I was doing jumps in that. Easy car to roll.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
Oddly, especially when you've really upped all of the engine on it, so it's really powerful. Three-wheeled car, if anyone
Not your know. Optimum hatchback.
Yeah. Famous if you know either Top Gear or Only Fools and Horses.
Mm.
There's a lot more community things. It's got the usual all your friends list is there as driver tars.
Oh, yeah.
And also now you hire some of them and fire them.
Mm-hmm.
I fired one of you.
Oh, dear. You're hiring and firing listeners. Yeah. Good grief.
Which gives you various things.
It's them I feel sorry for. They've got you on their machines, tear arsing around and ramming them off the road and not bothering to brake.
One of the guys from work did send me a clip this morning showing... when he had to try and beat me to get me to hire me in his game, and exactly how close he came to not beating me.
He's a normal, rational human being in real life, but for some reason, the distillation of his driving skills as a driver tar is something terrifying to behold.
It's the ruthlessness.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, of course. I have to, of course, mention the fact that it does mean that the annual rivalry with Dot Chaos is up again.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah. We both constantly see each other on our lists of things we're doing.
It's good to have a hobby.
Yeah. The game is fantastic. It is absolutely stunningly fantastic. There's a PC version, which, if you bought the digital version, you get for free, although it means the digital version was more expensive, but yeah, which I haven't got around to installing it because I can play on Xbox, which has crossplay. The saves are the same, stored on the cloud.
That's quite sensible.
You've got multiplayer between the two.
Yeah, why doesn't more games do that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and fantastic. I bought the Xbox copy, got the PC version for free. What more?
Yeah.
That's just how you should do it, although
that's the future.
Cost of the Xbox version should come down because it means I'm paying more for a PC game than I'd usually pay for a PC game.
But you've got an Xbox game as well?
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, it's the same game, exactly the same, except for the fact it'll run in 4K.
So if you bought it on the PC, do you get a free Xbox version?
Yeah.
Okay. So you probably should have done it that way around.
It's exactly the same because it's through the Windows Store. So yes, the game is absolutely stunningly fantastic. It looks gorgeous. The skies are fantastic. It's got the usual sunrises and sunsets that are going to make you think, oh, I really want to be in Australia now. The landscape is fantastically spectacular. The transitions between the various landscapes, you know, when you're going from rainforest to outback, it doesn't feel like you're just going through a tunnel and then you're there. It sort of gradiates nicely, so you don't feel like it's really
cut off biomes, Minecraft style. Yeah,
it doesn't do any of that. The driving is really good. The car section's brilliant. The soundtrack is brilliant because it supports groove music, so you can put your own soundtrack in. You don't have to listen to any drum and bass.
Does it come? Yeah. What's the in-game radio station soundtrack playlist like?
It's the usual. There's an Australian indie one. The two I'm listening to is the groove one, which is basically I put it to a chill out ambient one, and also the classical one, Timeless, which is basically lots of classical music, bizarrely music from Halo. And a rather sarcastic announcer who doesn't like cars or stuff, which I quite appreciate.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's fantastic. I recommend everyone who likes driving games plays it because I do think it is the best driving game of the consoles.
Wow, that's high praise. Mm. Excellent. So I'm talked out.
I'm talked out too.
Do your spiel.
If you go along to howtomurdertime.com, you will see links to all our previous shows and also how to find us in games, find our Steam group, how to find us in Slack, and many ways in which you can talk to us, many of which we will actually respond to. You can also go on to YouTube, a link again on the site, where you can see all of our videos and all our past videos and future videos. You can subscribe to them.
Ramming a rocket into moon.
Yeah, you can like them. You can see the video version of this, which is basically Tim being incompetent in...
does happen
in Kerbal, and if you join us next week, we'll be back with more stuff.
See you next time.
Goodbye.